because of those who were flying out.
Yes.
Oh, thank you very much for being understanding, ne? Our
Pleasure.
apologies again. Eh?
No.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You're
At least you are going
welcome.
to sleep here in Cape Town.
Compared to the other ones.
We'll ask them not to organize very morning flight, but they must organize a flight, a later Nyana flight around 10, 11.
I hope the flight is fine. It should be. It's about at 11.
Oh, no, it's fine. Thank you very much. Yeah, because we are the ones who delayed you, ne? You have 47 minutes with us. 3 minutes is for you to answer questions. And 2 minutes it's for members to ask you questions. We are 11 of us. You'll be fortunate if you are being asked questions by 10 or 7 members. You'll be very fortunate. So if you are not fortunate, you'll be asked by less, but it's highly impossible. You'll be asked by almost all of us questions. It's up to you that you give us answers. Don't try to bring preambles and history and what Vasco da Gama was, what or Jan van Riebeeck. Don't. We are advised because that will take most of your points and most of your time, and we are not going to score you when you bring such, you know. So just introduce the subject and give us the answer. Feel free and be comfortable, and wish you good luck. Yeah, so the first question is about you yourself. Tell us about yourself, who you are, where are you coming from, and why do you think you are a suitable candidate to be appointed as one of our gender commissioners?
My name is Busisiwe Dei. I call myself a lawyer. I have an LLB. I have an LLM in Human Rights and Democratization from the University of Pretoria, and I recently attained my MA in Gender and Law from the School of Oriental and African Studies. My main concentration work that I have done is within the NGO space. I briefly worked at the Constitutional Court of South Africa as a legal research clerk for Justice Edwin Cameron and Justice Mahlatsi for a period of 12 months, which is a year. I have worked in the NGO space, as I said. My primary focus areas have been human rights, equality, and non-discrimination, or END. I've worked with organizations such as Gender Dynamics, the Legal Resources Center. I've worked with NGOs such as the Women's Legal Center Trust, which is based in Cape Town. I've also worked with a transcontinental organization called the Institute for Strategic Litigation in Africa. Cases that I've worked on include on abortion rights. I've worked on and been briefed on the right to abortion in general, but the right to bury remains of stillborn children or undeveloped fetuses or miscarriages. I've worked on a case called the Tanzania 13, which was a case about the arrest of human rights defenders in Tanzania on allegations of promotion of homosexuality, and I was briefed and I provided a brief, a legal opinion on that. I've worked on teaching public interest litigation to lawyers across the African continent, but particularly focusing on Nigeria. That project kind of fell through last minute because I was preparing for this interview. But yes, I'm primarily, I've worked in the NGO sector, but I'm also an academic. I work with constitutional law. I work with queer theory. I worked with trans politics. Those are my main frameworks of thought. I've written publications on the adoption of the third gender marker in South Africa by using the constitution as a framework. I have worked on the Alteration of Gender Identity Act, which allows transgender individuals to change their gender markers on their identity markers. I've worked on litigation on that particular issue as well, because there was a lack of a bridge between the Marriage Act and the Civil Unions Act. So I was one of the litigation strategists around that particular case. That case was won in the Western High Court. The case name is KOS and Others versus the Minister of Home Affairs and Others. So that's briefly the work that I have
done.
Yeah,
thank you very much. Honorable Standa, Honorable Thembekwayo, Honorable Kaula, Dr. Maisela, Dr. Thembekwayo, Honorable Tseke, Honorable Maluleke, Mam Story, Honorable Velma.
Very lucky. Thank you very much. Good evening. My name is Terry Stander. Thank you very much for coming through today. I'm very interested in this third marker gender theory that's starting to gain traction. But you seem to have worked on a lot of legal casework, yes, specifically relating to, what is it, trans politics and queer. Don't worry, you don't have to come in right now. But it's certainly in the field of gender identity and the legal framework there around. Now, if you are appointed as a commissioner, what do you see your role, your unique niche? Because this is quite a niche field. It's legal and it's specific to really gender identity. How are you going, what is your purpose? You're a commissioner in the CGE. This is your background. This is, seems to be your passion, your focus. What are you going to come in and change? What are you going to come in to shake things up or create something new or address a particular issue that you have identified, and how? Within the powers of the CGE.
People are doing that to you, you complain, eh?
Should I? You are correct. I do not think that my work should be considered niche. Gender is something that permeates throughout societal structures, and how we understand gender is important in how then we address systemic and structural issues that we feel are impediments to attaining equality. Having gone through some of the documents briefly on the Commission for Gender Equality, I am concerned, and it did jump out, that how the Commission defines gender is what I call add woman and stir. You know, when you have a recipe and you add salt and you stir for taste, it's almost as though we don't understand that women are, the idea of gender itself goes beyond womanhood, and how we understand it is then how it gets translated into our laws, our legislation, and how we then interact with it in terms of policy structuring, right? And I think that we should move away from considering, I want to put this in a way that doesn't get too abstract and theoretical, but considers the structures of power that impede women from achieving what they need to achieve economically and socially. how do we incorporate gender in our transport system, for instance? How do we incorporate gender in how we design our cities, for instance? If I walk out of here now, I do not feel safe. Why? Not necessarily I am a woman, but I am not a man, right? I am not afforded the same levels of protection, right? I'm not assumed to be tough enough to fight off a perpetrator, right? And so how do we design cities? So to answer your question directly, my big thing is how do we incorporate gender in everything we do? From criminal procedure to transportation systems. How do we ensure that women feel safe moving from point A to point B, feeling safe? Women, gender non-conforming people, transgender women and men and individuals, but also sex workers. That's an important demographic that we forget. How do we ensure that our cities protect our sex workers? And so for me, it's about taking a step back and seeing how gender can be incorporated into everything, not necessarily women become an afterthought and we bring women in and say, how do we include women into this already made policy? So that would be my answer to you.
Next.
Thank you very much. It's Dr. Susan Tembekwayo, and welcome, Busi. You compiled training manuals for human rights lawyers in public interest litigation and constitutional litigation. You further worked at Constitutional Court of South Africa for a period of a year. My question is, what changes do you believe can be made to the criminal justice system to improve the conditions of men, applying what the contents are in your manuals, presumably? Secondly, gender-based cases in South Africa are left outstanding, cancelled, delayed, or missing. What can you do to bring an end to this should you be appointed as a commissioner? Thank you.
Can I just ask your first question? You said men, right? I heard you right. How can I better the criminal justice system and how it deals with men?
Conditions of women.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, the criminal justice system, I believe the criminal justice system is wholly inadequate and unable to deal with women, particularly women's issues, gender non-conforming, LGBTI peoples, when they present themselves to open a case. And the refrain is always, why don't you open a case? Why didn't you open a case? It's because, as Professor Pumla Gola says, is that even though black women, LGBTI, gender non-conforming, trans women have presented themselves, post-1994 there was a dramatic increase in black women trusting the system, but the system failed them continuously, right? And why was this, right? Because the criminal justice system was simply not made to understand and to also counsel these groups of people, right? And it was centered around, I would say, you know, understanding and providing services for white men. And so how then is a system like that reconfigured to be welcoming to those demographics? I mean, the government of the time did take steps towards that. Those were the Tutuzela centers. And those were a great intervention, and they worked, right? Tutuzela centers were one-stop shops, right? You get in, you have been assaulted, and you get everything. You get your social workers, you get your medical treatment, you get your police, but also you get trained staff. However, that has fallen by the wayside. Also, specialized criminal offenses courts, there was testing sites for those, but we never rolled them out. So the government and our South Africa has the tools, but we do not have the political willpower to man those and to expand those systems. We have, and it worked. There were more cases being reported. There were more cases that evidence was being collected in manners that would sustain a case in court. So our systems have been working. So what happened? Why has there been this growing distrust? And it's because we have not sustained those efforts. And I think that it's about sustaining those efforts, right? It's about those sustaining those efforts. And I think those are very important, that we have a relook and push for that much more stronger and be much more vocal as the CGE. I'm already talking as if I'm part of, and I think the CGE should push forward with that and be much more vocal in getting those systems back up, because those systems worked. And women were starting to trust the criminal justice system, and they were starting to report. And I think it's in reporting and getting cases prosecuted that we teach people that there are consequences to doing particular violating acts. And I think that's very important. I hope that I've answered your question in the best way I can.
We do agree that a victim always like kicks other victims, right?
Pardon, could you please repeat yourself?
I
didn't quite catch that.
I said we do agree that a victim always likes kicking other victims.
I don't think we agree.
Okay.
On the surface, I don't think I agree with that statement.
Now, the law is not just, because it is a tool that is used by the owners of the means of production to keep others under check. And it is meant for them specifically. And we all have to swallow it, but they don't play by those rules that they made. And that's why for black people, they can't afford justice, because they are just guilty of something and they can't afford to buy the best liar in the world to lie for them and get away with it. So when we talk of jurisprudence, we must consider that we are conditioned to defend the system and perpetuate the system that is against our own best interests. But we are not even aware of this because of the conditioning, that we are merely doing the bidding of those who own the means of production, which we were dispossessed of. For 300 years, we have been fighting for this, 300 plus years. And today we are so conditioned that we are even more Catholic than the Pope. Okay? But fine. Now, when you talk about a political will, not doing something like that, no, we don't have a political will to do something, what. It is conditioning, nothing else. Because you can't work against your own interest if you know what your interest is and you can do something about it. So it is just a misnomer, and because we are conditioned just to stay along. Yeah? That's why I was going to ask you, how do you expect to solve the inequality? No? Let alone gender, just inequality in society. Are we unequal among ourselves or unequal with those who own the means of production or what? What type of inequality are we talking about here? That's why I was saying that you know that the victim always likes to kick another victim. It is posited on this type of analogy that if you don't have anything and somebody throws something somewhere, you don't want to share it with
time
somebody
is up.
Else. Thank you.
So, honorable story.
I thought you, is it you or somebody on the side?
I'm saying time is up, and then...
Oh, now, how do you, as a legal eagle,
okay, sorry, Dr. Mayifera. Another story. Your mic is off.
Chairperson, I thought we are interviewing the candidates on who are here because of their interest in participating in CGE, Commission on Gender Equality. And I thought, Chairperson, as an ad hoc committee, our responsibility is to ask questions that are relating to what we are here for, so that we are all moving, you know, in the same direction. Now, some of us get lost sometimes. Can you please conduct the meeting, Chairperson, for us, so that we are all understanding each other?
Anyway, Dr. Mayisala, the time was up.
My question is this.
Let him finish the question.
My question is this. How, if you are a commissioner, going to solve the question of gender inequality, considering that this inequality is brought about by what we are saying, we have just said? It's simple, because it's very complicated, right? And we are not just going to define the question, but to try to solve it, find solution to this inequality. Okay. That was
Doctor, myself, the forfeit table are still on the line because they're taking more than 2 minutes. In fact, you have taken 6 minutes. Busi, may you please just answer the question?
I don't think that I'm going to solve gender inequality. I think it's a system. I think it's structures that are multiple. But I think that the commission can make strategic interventions that ameliorate and mitigate some of the effects of that inequality, right? Something that I'm really passionate about is just how women, gender non-conforming, transgender women, sex workers move around in public spaces. I'm sure all the women in this room know how there's a level of safety if you are with a man in a crowd versus when you walk alone. Why is that? And how do we make strategic interventions in those simple daily things as the commission? In order for women to feel safer in public spaces, because that means economic access, because the public is where the economics happen. So I mean, it's a very broad question, but I hope, you know, that gives you a sense of my kind of thinking around what inequality means and how I try and think around how to make strategic interventions in order to make inroads. So that the next generation of people sitting in these seats and having these interviews have a lesser task ahead of them.
Thank you very much, Busi. Next.
Thank you very much, Che, and good evening, Busi. My question is, does the Commission for Gender Equality have powers to enforce government departments to implement its recommendations or findings? And if we have time, is the CGE, the Commission for Gender Equality, still relevant today, in your view, given the fact that we've got a fully-fledged Department of Women? Or do you support the view that it should be amalgamated with other Chapter 9 institutions, being your Human Rights Commission, your Cultural and Linguistic and Religious Communities, and other Chapter 9 institutions? Thank you very much.
Okay.
I'll start from your second question and move up. No, I do not think that the CGE should be amalgamated, but I do think that working relationships that are strategic between the CGE and other Chapter 9 institutions are important. And those relationships need to be stronger, and Chapter 9 institutions cannot be working in silos. They were envisioned in the Constitution in order to address specific areas, but with the understanding that the framework, there would be a network and cooperation. I think that the CGE is still relevant. I think that in the wake of Fees Must Fall, hashtag RU reference list, which is about sexual assault on campuses, I think that the CGE is very relevant, particularly around, you know, the rising reports on domestic violence and gender-based violence that's happening. The CGE does need to be more vocal. The CGE does need to be at the forefront in how these issues are articulated and the solutions that are provided. The CGE needs to be the organ, the constitutional organ that is looked to as a leader in those particular areas, particularly around provision of shelters for abused women, particularly around reform and interventions within the criminal justice system, the health sector as well. I think that the CGE needs to be the pioneer that it was. And I think that the CGE has much more powerful enforcement mechanisms. It can take matters to court. It can be a litigant. It can be an amicus, and I think that it hasn't really explored its amicus role. It's a friend of the court role, and it might be because it wants to be less antagonistic, but I think that friend of the court role is much more suitable for a much more dialogue, conversational way of helping the courts understand issues around gender. And I do think the CGE does need to be much more proactive in that line. So I do think that your questions are they're very interlocked and they're very important, but I definitely think that the independence of the CGE allows it to make much more directed, much more strategic interventions that come from a space of informed dialogue with perhaps the civil society groups that maybe, you know, other bodies do not have access to.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Busisiwe, I'm Mrs. Buitumelo Maluleke. The person who nominated you is saying you have extensive experience in work related to advocating for rights of the LGBTI people. Now, my question is, you are not going to work only if you are appointed as a commissioner, only in urban areas, but also in rural areas. And in rural areas, this group of people falling under this LGBTI, they don't even understand what is it. But you as a commissioner and as a person who advocate for the right of these people, how are you going to make sure that people in the rural areas, they understand what you are advocating for? Thank you.
This is a lovely question, because I used to work, my first job, I used to do workshops in deep rural KZN on intersex issues. And I found that there's a depth of knowledge, there's wealth of knowledge from rural communities about intersex children and how accepting that environment is. I mean, I remember being in Pietermaritzburg and, you know, a father presented his girl child who had been raised as a boy child, but she started developing and she had an undiagnosed intersex condition. And, you know, the father didn't want to change the child, but he wanted the community to understand the child, and that this was his child and this was his daughter. And you know, the switch from addressing, you know, his child, you know, having raised her as a son to a daughter was automatic. You know, as soon as she started expressing, as soon as she started affirming herself. And I think that, we know, we underestimate rural communities, and we think, you know, we associate ignorance with rural communities, but there's an organic sense of understanding things. And I find urban areas actually much more hostile to LGBTI communities. I grew up in rural Limode, Port St. John's. I did not need to be anything but myself. And I was always the tomboy. I was always, you know, accepted. It's only when I moved to, you know, urban areas where I began to be forced to be a girl or to act like a girl. So I think it's very important that we don't associate rural communities with ignorance, because there's a wealth of knowledge that we need to tap into, and that will be the space that helps us understand and gives us the language that is much more accepting than in urban areas. I don't think that acceptance lies in urban areas. I think it lies in rural areas. I mean, the most developed, you know, activists on intersex issues I found in rural KZN. You know, I thought I was going to teach people about intersex conditions, and they were teaching me. So I think that I'm not really worried about that. It's about also teasing out the language and asking people, what words do you have for A, B, C, D? So I think that would be my approach.
Chairperson, I think Honorable Maluleka reads my mind. I was going to ask a similar question about the issue of gender non-conforming people. Now, you have given us clarity on this. But I think I'm going to divert a bit, because I've got an experience of negativity amongst the African states when we are in SADC about the LGBTI issues. And seemingly these days towards, now that we are from these different countries, now lately, people were even, could see they want to keep it out of the agenda because of the negativity that we get, especially from our male counterparts. I just want to know, because I heard you talking about Nigeria, and how do you find our African state to be accommodative to the issue of LGBTI when you work with them? Yes.
In answering your question, so let me just be clear, I've worked in Zimbabwe, I've worked in Botswana, I've worked in Kenya, and remotely Tanzania, and now remotely with Nigeria. I think that knowledge systems exist about, and Uganda, sorry. I studied in Makerere University in Uganda. And I think that it's very important that, again, how we frame our understandings of knowledge and ignorance and who is ignorant and who's hostile. We have to be very careful in how we articulate that, because there are indigenous knowledges around LGBTI people in the countries that I have mentioned. Uganda, for instance, there is history around a king who had same-sex relations, right? There's history, historical accounting. Right? What happened to that history? And I think that it's a question of understanding who frames knowledge and who frames ignorance, right? And I think that if we are much more compassionate in how we relate towards understanding what is knowledge, right? What is human rights? What is and how do you understand it, right? When we say umdungu umdungabantu, what are the actual implications, legal, social, of that? It means my humanity I recognize through your humanity, right? So what does that mean when I violate your right to equality? Doesn't that mean that my right to equality is in danger, right? And so for me, it's about re-articulating these knowledge systems around, okay, maybe gay, the word gay doesn't exist in your language, but what words exist around describing these particular kinds of relationships, right? Because it's not going to be the word gay. It's not going to be one word. An example, for instance, the idea of saying unongai dota, right? That is a sense. I was called unongai dota when I was growing up, right? But that wasn't said with malice, right? So what does that mean? How do we understand, is that a man-like woman or a woman-like, a woman who exhibits, you know, what is going on with that word? And I think we need, you know, to interrogate linguistically, right? We have to have people who understand language and how language evolves, right? I don't think I have a very simple answer to your question, but I think that perhaps for me, I have a discomfort about framing other countries as hostile or ignorant just because they don't have the right to equality in their constitutions. They might have cultural formations and knowledges that we might learn from. And so perhaps it's a question of reimagining the question itself. I know that's a very hazy answer, and I'm very sorry that I can't give you one that's much more direct. But I am really fascinated by, maybe the question is wrong. Maybe the question is what knowledge exists, and maybe that's something that we need to explore further.
Yeah. I don't think the question is wrong. Yeah, the question is right, because if you take a situation like Zimbabwe, what is your opinion with regards to issues like what we're discussing now?
I think Zimbabwe is a country that's still discovering itself. I did my I did research on the constitutional process in Zimbabwe, and I think that it's a layered effect. I think that the democracy in Zimbabwe, although it's older than us, it's only maturing now. It's becoming into its teenagehood, and I don't think we should read countries the way we read people. And I think it's maturing, and it's going through growth spurts. And I think one of the ways in which we understand that growth is through contestation of power, which is what we're seeing. And all democracies have gone through this contestation of power. I don't know why African countries are expected to now all of a sudden be great when, you know, 20 years ago in a country's history is nothing. So how do we then perhaps look at that growth process and help sort of imagine possibilities out of it? Because Zimbabweans have to define Zimbabwe for themselves. South Africa cannot intervene in ways that allow Zimbabweans to understand what Zimbabwe is to them, right? There's still the issues of, you know, the Gugurahundi that happened that still need to be resolved. The LGBTI issues are part of that melting pot, and to say you must solve this now is perhaps not the approach, but to say that in the spectrum of issues, these people also need to be given, you know, attention and brought to the fore, and perhaps when we redraft the Constitution again, these people are in a much better position then to speak on their rights. What do they want? We don't know if LGBTI, you know, people in Zimbabwe want equality or marriage. Maybe they just want people to stop attacking them on the street. You know, they want police to protect them. And so starting from that standpoint is much easier than saying we want the right to marriage equality. I think it's my issue is perhaps wanting solutions that are solve this now. I think that's unfair, even for, you know, a country as old as Zimbabwe, right? It's unfair because it's a teenager in the spectrum of how countries grow. I mean, you know, countries that we compare ourselves against are 300 years old. I mean, you can't compare yourself to the UK. It's, you know, it's grown. It's gone through different revolutions. You know, we still have to go through that.
Mom's story is...
I think Busisiwe is quite right when she talks about maybe we can be educating ourselves. My concern is that I'm talking about lawmakers in those countries. If they wanted to engage on this, it was something else. They literally just dismiss it and with anger, you know, when this issue comes up. And because we are these countries that are supposed to work together, it becomes we don't want to go to these countries and maybe undermine their sovereignty. But I think because we are countries that are supposed, that is the concern that we have. And I think I would like really, Chairperson, if it comes to a push, we have somebody like Ubusisi in this, because we would engage more with her. And maybe she would understand our concern if she is in the CGE. I do accept the response that she gave us. And that is how she understands it. And when we engage, we might be able to teach each other. Yes.
Yeah, she gave us a lot of information. Thank you very much, and Mom's story. Honorable Kaula, you are the last one.
Ngibonge sihlalo. Siyajabula ukuthola abantu abanjengo umhlonishwa uBusisiwe. Ngoba kuningi osikutholayo. Lana busizo uzowe ngithi lokhoza kunalezi ndawo ngani yami lezo thola ukuthi semahostele kulama hostel thola khona abantu besifazane labantu besifazane abanamkhulumeli lapho ngento eningi engiyibale la ngoba izwe lonke liyabuka kodwa laba bantu abanamkhulumeli khona nabantwana abancane lapha nabesilisa thola ukuthi balala endlini eyi-1 omunye uyayiphuzela, uyichamela noma ikanjani, yibo loo nto enjalo. Ngifuna ukwazi ukuthi if uma ngabe kwenzeka uyakwenzeka uyangena la, yini ongasilekelela ngayo ukuthi bona bengaziboni besele ngaphandle njengabantu nabo abayiphatha lelizwe abangabavoti. Indlela abahlala kuyona ngokwempilo ayikho right, ngokwezindlu ayikho right, nanesimo sakhona sirafu nanibone kuphuma kuma-TV ukuthi kuyadutshulwana. Laba bantu bebehleli lapha bagcina sebebizwa ngamagama athize engengiwasho la akhombisa khona njalo ukululaza nokubukela phansi isithunzi somuntu wesifazane. Kanti uzothola ukuthi labo bantu njengoba belapha babesuswe zindlame noma izathu ey'thize beze bayithole belapha. Yini ongenza sure ukuthi bathola indawo bakwazi bakhelwe kubuyiswa isithunzi sabo ngoba inhloso yaleli komiti ukubona abantu bakithi sebelahle ithemba bebuyela bekwazi ukuthi beyibona bayabantu njengabavoti bala eSouth Africa. Ngiyabonga.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Khuluma. Yangoma nazo.
Thank you, Chair. I'm happy to meet somebody
Hello.
Like you, Miss.
Sorry. You heard. Yeah. But you'll speak Venice for the benefit of other members, ne?
Abana ngisho ama ID ngisho certificate laba bantu. Abantwana.
Hayi,
abe Venice card sincane.
Hayi.
Ngisho ama clinic.
Kubeka busisi.
Thank you for that question. It's such a multifaceted question that requires more time, but also that requires expertise and particular kinds of issues. I'm not sure that I'm comfortable in coming before you and giving you an answer that makes me seem as though I am an expert, right? But I do think that there needs to be what I call networks of access, right? There needs to be ways in which people in those spaces can access particular government interventions, like having an identity document. How do we make it easier for people to access having an identity document? Because your identity document, we always carry it around, but we never realize how much it becomes an access card to social security, to banking finance, to housing in terms of renting. It's imagine your life when you have lost your ID. You cannot even access your bank accounts. And so how do we make sure that just this, at the simple level of access, we ensure that those things are not difficult to attain? You know, what is the distance between from a hostela to the nearest home affairs? What is the distance between from a hostela to the nearest clinic? What is the distance from a hostela to the nearest police station? How do we ensure that those communities have access? And access is sort of like this intangible word, right? You know, you say access, but we understand what we mean when we say access, right? We understand that, you know, people are not inclined to want to take two taxis to go to the clinic. So they'd rather not go to the clinic. So how do we make sure that we cut down those two taxis to just a walk? Or maybe one taxi? Or maybe a mobile clinic? So how do we intervene in those small but strategic ways that people begin to look beyond their poverty and their situation and the violence and see what steps they can take to improve their life? I know it's a wholly inadequate response, but those are just some of the ways I'm thinking about how a community in that space, we can begin to intervene. We're not going to change people's lives dramatically in 2 months, but how do we make sure that we give people the tools to access particular kinds of social benefits and security? Of course. Always.
Thank you very much, Busisi. We have learned a lot today. You have given us a lot of information which we'll need to digest. And aw, magu uwe faneke sivume.
I think that gender should not be, there's no use for it. I mean, it's always, the question is always, you know, we need to know whether you're a man or woman. But Stats South Africa always is able to get how many men and women are in the country. I think we can trust Stats South Africa. But also, it's just the idea of womanhood I'm not too comfortable with, but that's another conversation.
Thank you very much for coming, when I have taken much time, so there's no need for you to ask us questions. But thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We wish you good luck. Nelly, so I hope the accommodation is ready. Yeah, somebody will accompany you to the hotel. And tomorrow, at least, you will...